This is the Foresight Institute's 13th conference on advanced nanotechnology, and I'm very proud to be a co-host for this event. I'll tell you just a little bit about myself so you'll know my prejudices and background and know what filters to put on what I say. My background comes from strategic planning with big companies like AT&T and Sony and Unisys. Then a stint at Georgetown Medical School, and work as a professional futurist. I've been involved in nanotechnology since 1992, when I read Unbounding the Future by Christine Peterson, Gail Pergamut, and Eric Drexler. I was working at Georgetown Medical School at the time, and I read it in one sitting. There has not been a day since then that I haven't thought about what nanotechnology is, what it can be, what it might be, what it will mean when and if it happens. I really had that book changed my life completely, as I expect it has for others of you in the room. This conference is the grandfather of nanotechnology conferences, and I add and the grandmother, because it isn't just mechanically how do you make things, but it's also what will it mean when you do. So it's the hard side and the soft side. And to the best of my knowledge, it remains the only conference out of all of the conferences that you can find out there. In fact, I think if you were to put a calendar on your wall and throw a dart at it, pretty much any week you hit would have a nanotechnology conference somewhere. But to the best of my knowledge, this is still the only one that's dedicated to exploring both the midterm and long-term implications of nanotechnology. Definitions may change about what's short-term, midterm, long-term. I used to work for Sony, as I said, and we had a 100-year plan, and I'm not making that up. I also worked at Georgetown Medical School, where we had a 100-day plan and hope we survived to see whether the plan worked or not. They've since sold the hospital to a for-profit entity, so go figure. But anyway, this is the oldest and, I think, best of all the nanotechnology conferences in the world. Today's program is going to be chock full. We're going to talk about policy and applications. One might wonder why you put the two together, and there's actually a very intricate tie-in that I'll talk about in a bit. In terms of policy, we're going to talk about things like regulation, research funding, societal implications, international consequences, and lots of other things. Some of it will be straightforward in information. Some of it will probably be controversial. For those of you who were here for the Vision Weekend, Saturday and yesterday, you experienced some very interesting debates with very pointedly different points of view. We may see some of that again today. If you were not here for the Vision Weekend, talk to some people who were. Get some ideas about what happened. It really was incredible, and you might want to think about putting it on your agenda for the next time, because issues get discussed in that gathering that probably aren't covered in any depth in any other venue. In terms of applications, we'll be talking about the big things that matter, not just the building of molecular machines, which we all hope eventually to get to, but also the problems that those devices will be able to solve or at least help us with. Things like energy, no longer relying on oil would be a very nice thing. Medical and health issues, water and the environment. I will talk about this a little bit more later, but my personal assessment is that for this century, the number one issue facing us is going to be energy. If we don't solve that problem, it doesn't really matter what other problems we go after. We have got to stop relying on foreign sources of oil for our energy, partially for political reasons and partially because it is going to run out. We also have to stop using fossil fuels because of the damage that it does to the environment that I think we may be starting to see right now. Hurricane Wilma hit Florida this morning, I think, as a Category 3. We all know what happened with Katrina. There is some difference of opinion over whether global warming, greenhouse warming, has changed the frequency or intensity of hurricanes, but the evidence seems to be pointing towards an answer of yes. And so for a lot of reasons, we have to solve the energy problem. And I think the number two problem that we have to solve is water. Countries are desperate for water today. That problem is only going to increase throughout the world, particularly in the third world, but even in places like Australia. We have got to get our hands around safe drinking water, or again, it won't matter too much what other problems we go after. And just because you live in the central part of the United States where you're not going to have floods and hurricanes, water is still going to be an issue for you. Now let's talk about policy. I'm just trying to give you a flavor for what's going to happen today, so please don't expect a lot of depth here. This is kind of setting the table. Policy in general and policy for nanotech is mostly about who can do what, who gets to do what, to whom, and under what circumstances. It's a very political process. So if you don't know anything about political science and you want to think about nanotechnology policy, time to go back to Bone Up, read some books, talk to some people, maybe learn how to read some of the blogs that are becoming one of the best information sources for today. Policy is about who gets what money from whom. And it isn't just who gets government money, as we normally tend to think about it, but policy has implications on what private companies can do with their investments or should rationally do with their investments. So whether it's public or private or even philanthropical money, policy decisions will have an impact on who gets to do what, who gets what money from where. And policy is about whether and how government can help or hinder what it is you're trying to do. In terms of that who can do what, policy decisions will decide whether we allow or disallow research. Now, Bill Joy, in his article, Why the Future Doesn't Need Us, I think was the title, several years ago, called for relinquishment of nanotechnology, genetic technologies, and artificial intelligence because they were scary. If policymakers were to take his ideas to heart and follow his recommendation, we would find that we were not allowed to do nanotechnology research. Something that some people might want to consider as a good idea, but something all of us need to be prepared to think about and talk about. The ETC group out of Canada, Greenpeace, the Royal Astronomer in Great Britain have all issued reports that in varying degrees suggest that we should take a go slow kind of approach towards nanotechnology. And again, our policymakers are hearing about those reports, reading those reports. I don't think that any of the reports were as drastic as some people have said, but they weren't pro-nanotechnology go-go-go either, and they deserve a look. And we have science fiction writers like Michael Crichton, who wrote Prey, which I think will be a movie within the next year and a half or so. I'm told that Keanu Reeves has been hired to play the starring role. If that's the case, it'll be a blockbuster movie, and everyone will see swarms of stuff, something like I originally pictured utility fog as looking like, except that this is going to be sooty, black-looking stuff, and it's supposed to be nanobots. Well, the book is not about nanotechnology. It's about swarming AI. And its premise is that these swarming whatever nano things are going to want to take over human bodies. I can't imagine why a swarming little nano thing would want to take over a human body. There are a lot more fun things that it could do. But that's some of the science fiction that's coming out now. And a lot of people don't have the filters that hopefully you do. So we need to help inform the public. And the golden rule. He who pays gets to make the rules. That's always been the case, probably always will be the case. When I say that, I'm not saying that the National Nanotechnology Initiative is going to be in charge of everything because they're spending $1 billion a year. That $1 billion a year is a pittance. NIH gets $30 billion a year. We're spending hundreds of billions of dollars on Iraq. The $1 billion that the NNI invests in nanotechnology research is nice, and it's much better than what we had before Tom Khalil. Where's Tom? I saw you here earlier. Hi, Tom. Before Tom in the White House with President Clinton got the NNI passed and implemented, and then it was about $400 million, which was incredible given the fact that nanotechnology had only recently been thought of as science fiction or cargo cult science or something like that. But that $1 billion a year is not enough to make the rules. We need to find out who's going to be doing the serious investment that's needed in nanotech research. In terms of who gets what to do whom under what circumstances, so far we haven't had the requirement for relinquishment of the technology. But consider that there has been a ban on embryonic stem cell development through the use of U.S. government funding. Most of us in the scientific community would have thought such a policy impossible but yet it happened. The ban on human cloning is another example. It is not impossible to think that a U.S. government, not too far from here, too long from now, might put a ban on nanotechnology research. So policy, one of the most important policy issues is that, are we going to be allowed to do it? They've been doing a lot of toxicology studies. The results are mixed. On one hand, a lot of people supported by the NNI have said something roughly equivalent to, well, carbon nanotubes are short and spiky and pointy, kind of like asbestos, and we know how to test for asbestos damage, so we pretty much know what we need to do with the potential toxicology of nano things. I don't think that's the right answer, nor do a lot of people. And there have been some studies ongoing, particularly at Rice University. And there have been some studies that haven't been peer-reviewed yet. One, for example, said that little carbon buckyball smart bombs that were injected into fish agglomerated in the brain, and you have this visual imagery of exploding fish heads. I don't think that that has been proven yet, and we certainly need to think about how we're going to solve that kind of problem if it does crop up. But much more work needs to be done in toxicology. There have been tiny amounts of money spent on the ethical, legal, and social implications of nanotechnology. When the NNI was first proposed, and Tom can correct me if I'm wrong, but something on the order of 5% of the total funding was designed to go to the study of the ethical, social, and ethical, legal, and social implications. It turned out not to have been spent that way. I could count on two hands the number of millions of dollars that's been spent on that. Some money has gone to the University of South Carolina. Some has just gone to Arizona State, a little bit to UCLA. Most of the money has not been spent, no matter what other people tell you, on the ethical, social, and legal implications. That's one of the reasons why foresight is so important, because if the government's not going to ask these questions, then we need to. And another issue from the perspective of most of the people here is international competitiveness, and we'll talk about that later. So we'll talk about money, and I use euros because that's a more stable and valuable piece of currency today than the dollar. I'm sorry about that. Who gets what money from whom? We've talked about government basic research and how little the NNI is spending. Most of the research money that goes towards nanotechnology from the federal government goes through old boy networks. And that's not necessarily bad, because people who are handing out the money want to give it to people that they know and trust and are used to, because there is a higher confidence that something's going to be done. But since they've known these people for a long time and trust them, there's a very good chance that the research is just renamed what they were doing many years ago, in order to get on the nanotechnology bandwagon. They change the name of the program, and they say, this is chemistry we're doing. Well, of course, chemistry is nanotechnology. A lot of that's been going on, and a real quick little anecdote. Several years ago at an NNI meeting, a lot of people were talking about what they called nanotechnology, and all of it was about nanoparticles, and none of it was about active nanosystems or anything remotely approaching nanotechnology. And I went up to the mic, and I gave a little critique, a little hissy fit, and suggested that if people wanted to talk about nanotechnology, they should talk about nanotechnology. And this arm wrapped itself around my shoulders. It was Rick Smalley, who said, Dick, give them a break. They may not be talking about the real nanotechnology, but they at least allowed us to have some credibility so that we can come out from the public thought that it was science fiction to the thought that it is something serious. So you will always hear me say, that's not nanotechnologies, that's just little stuff. Nonetheless, there is some valuable research that's going on in this normal science. Industry is doing probably more than the government in terms of nanotechnology research. Most of that comes from for-profit companies who obviously have near-term objectives, and that's absolutely fine. But it does put some boundaries on the kinds of programs that they'll invest in. One issue that comes up from time to time is what I call buy to shelve. Any company that's successful has a marketing plan that's been in place for some time, a strategic plan, and any new product that comes along that competes with that plan is not necessarily a good thing. If it comes internally, it's even worse, of course, if it comes from someone else, from a competitor. So what companies will do is buy up intellectual property not to manufacture and commercialize and market, but rather to keep it off the market for a time so they can continue to work their existing commercialization plan. And then, of course, there's the question of intellectual property versus trade secrets, and we're going to talk about that in some depth later on today. And then there are the VCs. We have some here. They provide risk capital. Intellectual property there is critical. If you don't have patents, you don't get the money. And also, you're allowed to get the money if you can absolutely prove without a shadow of a doubt that you don't need the money. It's like it used to be with banks and taking out a loan. There's been very little money invested in nanotechnology by VCs to date. I could probably count again on two hands the number of serious investments by VCs. It's a lot of money waiting on the sidelines, but it hasn't been put into this field yet. I think you might start to see some breakthrough in that within the next couple of years. Don't expect it to be like the dot-com boom, because people are very afraid of another dot-com bust. But VCs are paying attention, are doing their homework, and are coming to meetings like this. And some of them will be wearing badges that say such and such capital, and some of them will be wearing badges that say so-and-so magazine. You can't really tell. So meet your neighbors and find out what they're really doing. The Valley of Death was discussed by Congressman Mike Honda on Saturday. I found this graphic, and I thought it pretty well represented that metaphor. University researchers get money from the government and run their labs for several years at a couple hundred thousand dollars a year each. And at that point, they've done as much as they can do for a basic research project. They can't get any more government money to do it because it's no longer basic research. It's now applied, and the NNI doesn't pay for things like that as a rule. But they're very far away from having something that's productizable 3, 5, 8 years, sometimes longer, before anybody could expect a profit or even to be able to flip a company to make their exit event that way. So there is, in between those two, this valley of death, and more good products have ended up on laboratory floors than ever made it to the marketplace. And so one policy issue that will be defined by applications, I think, that we need to think about is how to get through this valley of death, to get from the idea and breadboard of a product to the marketplace. Now, how can the government help? There are SBIR and STTR grants. If you don't know about them, there are plenty of people here that can help you. Talk to me and I'll point you in some directions. There's the Advanced Technology Program at NIST, which has been funded every year for a long time, but it usually gets zeroed out during the budget process until some senator at the end of the process comes back and says, wait, we need to do something. It's been criticized because it's supposedly helping pick winners and losers. I'm not sure that that's a valid criticism, but it's one that keeps coming back. Last year at this conference, AVC said that the best way to get money for nanotechnology research was the Advanced Technology Program. I don't think that's right, but we do have one more year to try to use that. Agencies put out broad agency announcements for solutions to problems. If you're reading about a broad agency announcement and that's the first thing you know about it, you're not going to win. Much better to read those to see who's putting out announcement to solve what problems, then go meet with them, and then you'll get to write the next BAA and get to play in the game. Of course, education and networking are things that the government can help us with doing. And applications, and I'll close very quickly after this. Normal science is what the NNI funds. Typically, the things that they do are not geared towards solving the big problems that I discussed earlier: energy, water, health, the environment, etc. I would contend that money will follow solutions to these problems. And it won't be government money, it'll be commercial money. But in things like, and I'll just go around that from the top left clockwise, instead of going to the doctor to find out if you're sick, you'll wear a patch or put something under your tongue or pull out a teardrop or blow your nose or something, and the diagnostic sensors will be there. They'll be non-invasive, painless, and you'll be able to go to the doctor with the knowledge of what it is that's wrong with you. We have 50 million people without health insurance. Being able to do diagnostics at home and at work will probably free up enough money in the system to let us provide health care for everyone. Water, as I said, number two problem of the century. materials. Just think about Katrina and Wilma and all the damage that were done to levees and buildings and windows and those kinds of things. Nanomaterials can help solve those problems. The pharma industry has always had a model of one size fits all, which has worked for a very long time but isn't sustainable in the future. They need to figure out how to do one size fits one with individualized medicine, and nanotechnology can play a great role there. I'll skip over to the other side. We saw some really neat films about DNA repair over the weekend. I hope we get to see some this week. And in the bottom middle, we have a road with a great deal of sun pouring down on it. This has been a dream of mine for a long time, and I'm not playing in this area, but I know other people are. Why we dig up oil from the ground and spew it out into the air when there's all this sunlight is a mystery to me. What if we could have roadways that were built with surfaces that collected sunlight and then transmitted the energy to the wheels of vehicles? Wouldn't that be a better solution? And nanotechnology offers us a potential way to get there or to something functionally equivalent. And I'm hoping that we'll learn some about that this week. This is how you can get in touch with me if you're interested. My email is rsmith@flexmedsys.com. It's a new company that I've started for the purpose of doing medical diagnostics. So I have to give you that disclaimer. When I talk about that problem, I have a solution. And my number is 703-447-8784. I hope you all have a wonderful conference. Look for people with staff badges if you need, want to get some help. If you have questions, don't hesitate to ask the Force.